Welcome to Authors on the Air, everyone. Happy Wednesday. I'm your host, Pam Stack, and this is the first of three big shows on crime fiction today. I'm glad you're here. Thank you for coming along with me on this great journey of crime fiction authors. My first guest is James Littwell. James has written his second book in his Detective John Penley series. It is called Bury the Past. The book is just released from Crooked Lane Press. I'm glad he's here. For those of you who don't know anything about Jim, if you want to see how to work a Facebook page, you've got to go and find him. He has a hashtag called Not My Cat that is absolutely almost trending in Facebook. It's so popular. We're going to talk about Not My Cat, and we're going to talk about Bury the Past. And here's my friend James. Welcome back to the show, Jim. How are you?
Good, Pam. It's great to be back.
I'm so happy to read this book because it's another great adventure that you're doing with John Penley and with Paula Newberry. And I like these characters a lot, but man, are they in hot water in this book. So I'm going to let you tell the story because, after all, you wrote the story. Let's hear the elevator pitch and take your time telling everybody about it, okay?
Sure. Thanks, Pam. Well, Bury the Past is the, like you mentioned, the second book in the series published through Crooked Lane Books. The first one was At What Cost, and this one is Bury the Past. And we have a detective pair featured in the book. It's based in Sacramento, and it's a Sacramento Police Department detective pair. And they're kind of based on some folks that I worked with during the time that I was in law enforcement. And in Bury the Past, a group of corrupt cops start turning up dead. And the only thread between them is that Paula Newberry, one of the detectives, was the one who put them away for their crime. There's evidence on the scene that goes back to one man as a suspect, but he's already in prison. So he's got the ultimate alibi. And the focus of the investigation starts to shift to Paula because she's the primary theme that runs through all these dead bodies that are turning up. And people start to question where her loyalties lie. So it's a kind of a rough journey for Paula, but she was really fun to write in this particular book. I really had a lot of fun writing her character through this one, Pam.
Yeah, she's a predominant character in this book, and I like that because I read a lot of crime fiction, and I like to see strong women characters in books, particularly in police procedurals, because it isn't always the case. They're always the afterthought or the victim, and so you've really paid a really nice homage to women, to strong women in your book. How when you were writing, Jim, I'm sorry, you were going to say something and I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's fine. I wanted to make Paula a central character in this book because I think she's got kind of a story to tell. Other women I worked with in law enforcement, women tend to have to work twice as hard to get the same recognition that their male counterparts get in this male-dominated field. My daughter is a probation officer, and she works her butt off to move forward. And it's a story that I think it deserves to be told. There's a lot of hardworking, good, professional law enforcement women out there that aren't getting the recognition they deserve.
Well, and that's true. And, you know, this past year has proved that a lot. We've had a lot of going on in society that is actually speaking just to that. So, I love that. I love that about this character. I want to ask you, how do you approach writing a strong female lead and a strong male lead? Because obviously there are subtle and then not so subtle differences between these two characters. So how do you get inside your female character's head? I would imagine it's easier doing the male character. So how do you know you're writing for the female and not and being authentic with it.
Right, and not just passing it off as just another voice, just with a woman's
exactly.
name attached to it.
Yes.
Yeah. It. I think you're right that writing the men's point of view kind of comes naturally.
Sure.
But I've worked with so many women in my career, and I've seen some of the struggles they've gone through and some of the issues they've had and how they've had to interact with their colleagues. So that kind of informed a lot of what I've got going on. But then I've got a really good group of people that I'm working with that kind of look at what I'm submitting and what I'm doing. My agent Liz is dynamite for looking at am I getting the tone right on this? Am I mistaking a woman's point of view for a man's, that kind of thing. I had my wife look at it, and she'll, like she did in the first book, no mother is going to say this, you better change that, or no woman would ever say this to a man, that kind
right.
of kind of correction. And then the folks at Crooked Lane Books, they've had a good interaction and during our editing passes on making sure we got the message out the way we wanted to.
A lot of times what is the big fail for me when I'm reading is that the characters' words are similar, the timbre, the nuance, the cadence of speech is similar, but you have kind of really not, I see two very distinct characters when I read your work. And so I have to give you kudos for that, because it is frustrating when the dialogue becomes interchangeable. It should never be like that. It should never be interchangeable between your male and female characters. You've mentioned now a couple times your career in law enforcement, but I want you to clarify that you are not a cop on the street. You saw criminals in a totally different way than a prosecutor or a cop would see them. Will you tell a little bit about
right.
your background, please, Jim?
Sure, absolutely, Pam. I worked for the Department of Corrections here in California for about 29 years. I worked in prisons, parole, and probation on the county level before that even. But yeah, I worked in the prison system. I was in prisons all over the state, anywhere from Folsom to Pelican Bay to Corcoran, and all the women's prisons as well. I was an associate warden, as the director of state parole for a while. And what I've been kind of learning is that the interactions with people on the inside, I'm talking about people that work on the inside with inmates and parolees, there's a different quality about that relationship. I mean, if you're talking about a cop on the street, you're interested in tracking them down, nailing them, and getting them behind bars, and it's everything is in a straight line. It's in a kind of an investigation. But behind bars, the quality of that interaction changes. You're living with this person for 8 hours a day. So you get to know what they're really about, outside of the nasty thing that they did to get themselves in prison. But it's a different kind of quality to the interaction. And I think that kind of plays through in some of the things that I write.
You know, most people, and I'm making an assumption here, but the way prison wardens are portrayed in television and film is that of a real, ball buster, if you'll excuse the expression.
Oh, yeah. And
I would imagine that some are, but I would also imagine, and I have to backtrack a little bit. You and I have spoke before after your first book, and you told me that you grew up even on prison grounds and that some inmates – you would play with you in your yard and they cleaned
right.
your pool and cut the grass and everything. You have a total different spin on inmates, don't you? Because of the way you were raised and all.
I think I do. And we didn't have a pool. That would have been nice. But the inmate gardener would come around and cut the grass. And here I was, a little nipper of, all of, six, 7 years old. And this inmate would wheel me around in the wheelbarrow as he was cleaning up the yard. I lived on prison grounds because my father, you know, worked in the prison system, and he was a conservation camp lieutenant, which is a smaller minimum security facility. And it didn't really dawn on me at the time that the guy wheeling me around was actually serving life for a robbery murder that went bad. And I just always called him Mr. Hall because he was an older guy, and that's just, you know, what you do. But yeah, I've got had a different interaction with inmates, both, you know, growing up and through the prison system, both, you know, through living on grounds and then living in it, that I think is kind of informed what it is I try to get out on the page.
I want to say this, but I'm not sure how to say it. I think that you probably have more patience and maybe more compassion than most people would, but certainly a better understanding of why people are behind bars. So having said that, and you talk a lot about your interactions and your everyday, you know, goings on with inmates. Were there times that you were really afraid to be around an inmate, that they just, you couldn't get through no matter what?
I think there's always times where you know that something big is going to kick off. I remember at Folsom, we had a couple of hundred inmates that, you know, refused to get off the yard and didn't want to lock up. And here you've got this swarming mass of a couple of hundred inmates on the main yard. And that could have gone any number of ways. But the staff that I worked with, I mean, you could count on one another. You were a unit. You knew we had each other's back. And we were able to kind of go in and just diffuse the situation and get the folks to lock up. And, you know, they don't need to drag this out. Nobody needs to get hurt. Just go back to your house and, you know, we'll listen to the issues that you've, you know, got grievances on, you know, in an appropriate way. But, yeah, there's a lot of what goes on in prison. I think it's true in most law enforcement, is just day-to-day, boring, routine, monotonous stuff. It's that 5% kind of raises the hackles on your neck and like, you know, this could go any number of different ways and most of them aren't good. But it helps to have the right kind of people working with you when those kind of situations come up. And I was fortunate. I always did.
So this book in Bury the Past is about a bunch of corrupt cops that get in trouble for drugs.
Right.
But these guys are mean. These are mean people. I don't think that these are the ones you're diffusing a situation on, are you? Are you taking liberties, do you think? Or is this the reality of it? Yeah.
I think there's some truth to it. I think if you're in this drug bust that went bad that these cops were involved in, that was actually based on a local drug interdiction network that went bad. There were 25 felony indictment counts that came out of the task force that went corrupt.
Wow!
If you're going to get yourself involved in that kind of stuff, you know, stealing drugs, reselling it, you know, blackmailing dealers, you're probably not a model citizen to begin with.
Right.
But you know, even if you're, you know, just in prison for a burglary or whatever, it's a different lifestyle in prison, and emotions run very hot very quick. So you have to be, you know, ready to kind of interdict and intervene in that kind of thing and kind of resolve some of those things as they come up.
So did you modeled some of your characters, your bad guys, based on a true story that you've kind of given your own fiction twist on?
Yes.
And it works, by the way, listeners. This is an amazing book. I read pretty fast, but this book's about 300 pages, and it flies by. The dialogue is so well written. There's a lot of action in this. I wholeheartedly recommend it. And I'll be putting up my review soon for you. You're welcome. This is the second book. Will we see these detectives again?
I hope we will. I'm working with the publisher on book number three. You know, if they want to continue with the series or do something different with another character, but I've got one ready to pull the trigger on.
Really, I know this. I know that you have your inspiration from a lot of different places, and I recognize that. I also know from speaking to authors that they have a lot of different ideas for stories. So how do you know which story you're going to write?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go through these periods of drought where I'm not sure what the next story is going to be. And I'll just start listing out all the ideas that, you know, I've got pinned up that are like things that could be turned into stories. And it's what's turned out to be the case is one of these will kind of grab me with kind of like, okay, what is this going to look like? Or what is it going to sound like? And then it just starts to kind of, that's the one that just steps forward. It's been kind of a fun process to do. Matter of fact, I was just doing it the other day because I'm right in between projects and I'm trying to guess which one to work on next. And one of them just started kind of, I don't want to say brighter on the page, but it just said, you know, this is the one that, you know, in the current social climate, this one has something to say. And it seems like it might be the one that to hit next. And then it just starts to kind of come together after that. And then the others just kind of go back in the bin for the next go through.
Interesting. Are you an observer and a listener of people's conversations when you're out and about?
Yeah, I'm an eavesdropper. I do.
I have been told that writers are the biggest snoops in the world.
I believe it. I absolutely believe it.
How fun. I'm not going to keep you for a long time, but I do want to do a final five with you, which is five quick questions and five quick answers. But first I want to ask you about Not My Cat, because Not My Cat has become a Facebook phenomenon. Will you tell listeners a little bit about how Not My Cat, which is a hashtag, by the way, came about?
Right. Yeah. Hashtag not my cat. It honest to God is not my cat. It's a black cat, and we estimate she's about 7 or 8 years old because she's been kind of roaming around the neighborhood for that long. The owner lives 2 or 3 houses down. We know it. The cat knows it. The owner knows it. But lately this cat has kind of, you know, it's always kind of been around the yard and around the house. But now she's sneaking in the house, and I found her, you know, asleep in the upstairs guest room. I found her in the laundry room, hiding in a basket where we put recycled plastic bags. She's taken over my chair downstairs. She's on the couch. She joins me every morning for my coffee. She's not my cat, and she just won't go away. And the dog is not at all happy with this. So
you have corgis, right?
I have. Yeah, we did have two therapy dog corgis, but one passed away in December. So we've got one therapy dog corgi, and Emma is not at all thrilled with Not My Cat taking over her limelight.
Now, of course, everybody laughs at you because you keep, and you even know the cat's name. But she now is infamous for being hashtag not my cat. Do you speak to the owners? Do they know that Not My Cat is living at your house?
They know it's hanging around. It's not, and I'm not going to say she's living at my house. She hangs out here a lot. but yeah, the owner knows it because the cat will come with me and walk with me when I walk the dog. in the morning, the cattle go around the block with the dog and me. And
it's very strange.
Circuit. It's just so bizarre. And the cat and the owner will look and say, oh, there's Case. That's the cat's given name is Case. And she says, she looks like she's doing fine. I said, yep, she's doing just fine. And then we go on our walk and come back.
Who feeds Not My Cat?
I think Not My Cat uses the neighborhood like a Vegas buffet. She hits every backyard, everybody who leaves dog food out, cat food out, she hits it all. Her owner gives her canned tuna. And we've got a little bowl that we set up in the recently that we set up in the laundry room so she can get a snack here if she absolutely needs it.
It's just so, how does she get in your house?
Well, because we had dogs, we thought it'd be a good idea to install a dog door in the laundry room. It's just
right.
A little one because they're corgis, you know, they're low,
right.
Low and long and, you know, can slip through a
right.
little hole. The dog, neither one of them liked to use it. Cat has no trouble using it. So the cat just slips right in and, you know, makes her presence known. And yeah.
You kind of sigh when you say that. It's just, and everybody has, because she does spend more time at your house than anybody else's. So does she spend the night?
Yeah, I think she does. I think she spends the night, but, you know, I'll come down and get my coffee in the morning. It's still dark out. And I'll be getting coffee together, and all of a sudden I hear this click click of the dog door. You know, so like she was waiting for me to wake up so I could, you know, be with her.
You've been adopted, Jim. I have to tell you. I know you keep denying it, but when she
Something.
You know starts getting her mail there, you'll know. I want to also talk about. I beg your pardon. Betrayed, the anthology.
Oh yeah.
The authors on the Air Press put out a book this past October about kick-ass crime survivors, and we ask for submissions with the proceeds going to the Naples Shelter for Abused Women and Children. And I think you were one of the first people that wrote a story. Your story is wonderful. It's just wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that you decided to do that. Why did you submit a story?
Well, the theme of the anthology was, you know, crime survivors, and it kind of focused on that personal violence that happens, you know,
right.
behind closed doors, and people don't want to talk about it.
Right.
And I had, in my career, I had seen a lot of women get trapped in that situation where they had nothing else to do except to, you know, the most extreme response, and that is they killed their husbands. I remember three women, you know, vividly in my career who, you know, had everything had failed them. The social networks had failed them. The police had failed them. Women's shelters were full or at capacity, or there weren't any, and they were stuck in this cycle of violence. And sometimes it's generational, but they're stuck in that violence cycle. And the only thing they can do to get their lives back in control is to actually kill their abuser. And these three women did, and they went to prison. And my story, you know, When the Music Stops, is kind of based on that kind of dynamic and women trapped in that cycle. And I don't know if we lost connection there, but I'll just keep talking just in case.